This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're tuned into The Property Show, a weekly take on all things property related, and I'm Sim Wee Boon. It's the last Friday of the month, and as usual, Chris Tan of Cheer Associates is our guest for the Property Legal Clinic today. Good morning and welcome to the show, Chris. Welcome back. Happy 2021 to you.
Happy 2021 to all of us and to you, Sim.
Okay, so let's kickstart with our first question. It's via WhatsApp. It comes from T.H. Lim. So this is the situation he's describing. For strata property, it's common for the management office to issue a bill or statement for the monthly maintenance fees on a bi-monthly or quarterly basis in advance. However, for late interest, if any, is the MO required to issue a monthly bill or statement to owners concerned? If there's no such issuance of a monthly bill or statement by MO, can owners claim ignorance of such and need not pay for the late interest? This is so when the next bill or statement issued could be in 2 or 3 months' time for the next maintenance fee bill or statement. What do you have to say to that, Chris?
Okay, I think I want to, first of all, not receiving a bill is not a valid excuse for the owner not to pay service charge, right? So paying of service charge is statutory obligation for all strata owner and is pursuant to Section 25 sub 1 and 52 sub 1 of the Strata Management Act. So my advice to TH Lim is that, you know, there's no way that you can run from paying the maintenance and sinking fund just because you never receive it.
So if he never receive it, the onus is on him to kind of like reach out and ask or kind of like find out, is it?
Yes, and then set out a procedure to ensure that he always receive it. So I think there's a few ways of sending these things. Obviously, if you are making it known specifically to the management, and the management will therefore take note of it, or sometimes the management just put the bill into your mailbox, right? So these are things that as owner is the obligation and it's the duty of the owner to find out, and the fact that not receiving a bill doesn't mean that you don't have to pay. However, in the computation of late payment interest, as far as, you know, because it's due and you didn't pay and there's a late payment interest to be charged on you, the fact it must then, there is a duty to prove that the receipt of the bill by the MO in relation to this. So it's two things. Number one is that you always have to pay. Number two is that whether they can impose the late payment interest, then it got to do with whether the bill is properly received or not as the owner.
All right. Okay. Let's move on to our next question, which comes from Sean. Hello, Chris and Sim. I'm a first-time future condo owner in KL, and I'm curious to know more about quit rent, parcel rent, and assessment rates. Why do I have to pay them, and what's the significance behind these payments? Do they differ from place to place, and do they even apply to new or old houses?
Thanks, Sean, for your questions. It's a very valid question. A lot of people don't understand what this is. If I may just ask you, these are actually the form of land taxes that's applicable in Malaysia, and it is actually imposed by the local government as well as the state government. First and foremost, you must know that, you know, there are two authorities who's collecting taxes from you. Mainly is the federal government, but then for the state government, because of them administrating the land, they do have the right in relation to these land taxes in relation to a quit rent and assessment. So assessment is a local land tax collected by the local council to pay for developing and maintaining local infrastructure and services. This tax is essentially a charge to maintain the local area. You have to pay for things like, for example, lighting by the roadside, cleaning of the parks, collection of the municipal ways, you know, and also other miscellaneous tasks that make the well-maintained the place of the locality for you to enjoy. So in another hand, the quit rent is a land tax imposed on owner for qualifying properties by the respective state government. This basically for the fact that state government administrating your ownership and recognizing your ownership and protecting it, you'll need to pay your quit rent each year for as long as the property is under your ownership. As for what is a parcel rent, you did mention that because you say you're a condo owner and there's something that's newly introduced called a parcel rent. The parcel rent is actually another name for quick rent, but instead of, and it's designed for a stratified property because normally a quick rent is paid for the entire strata development. And now in a parcel rent situation, they break it down whereby for each of the parcel in the strata development, you have to then pay this thing called a parcel rent. So by you paying the parcel rent, there's no need to pay the quick rent anymore.
Mm. And what happens if you miss these payments?
The consequences can be quite severe, but not for strata property, because strata is very hard to do that because there's a forfeiture element if you don't pay, whereby they'll forfeiture your, if you don't pay your quick rent, there is a provision under the Act to forfeit your ownership.
All right, okay, moving on to our next question from Nurul. Since the MCO hit last year, I've started to rent out a room in a condo that I live in to ease my monthly burden. She says that she's the owner of that unit and she's been paying a monthly loan for that unit. There was no tenancy agreement between my tenant and me because everything was done via word of mouth and we both wanted to seal the deal quickly. But now I'm wondering if the tenancy is legitimate without a signed agreement between both sides. Can I come up with an agreement myself for my tenant to sign? But if I do things independently, should I be concerned if the agreement would be invalid, especially in unwanted and unforeseen circumstances?
So first and foremost, Nuru, just to for start for benefit of all our listeners also, a verbal agreement is a valid agreement under the law, subject to, of course, a lot of proof and all these things. So, for example, in this case, you have verbally allowed the tenant to stay in your place and he or she is paying you a renter. And these things, by virtue of the conduct, already show that the contract is valid, the fact that there is payment, there's deposit paid and whatnot, right? So, but obviously, the better advice would be having a proper tenancy agreement in place would help if there's any dispute. But just for a start, a verbal contract is valid in the eye of the law, right? And if you want to use your own version and can you draft your own tenancy agreements, there's nothing wrong to it. As long as you know you as a landlord and a tenant is willing to sign, is signed willingly, then again, the agreement is valid, right? Section 10 of the Contract Act to say that all agreements are valid if they are made by the free or consent party or competent contract or lawful consideration with lawful object, which means that as long as everything is legal and there's payment concern, there's exchange of consideration, the contract will be valid, right? So I want to highlight also very importantly as to whether the version of the tenancy agreement that you drafted managed to cover everything. That's another question, Nuru. And I think it's important to bear in mind that, you know, maybe a professional consultation is required or more information need to be gathered before you just simply plug a sample tenancy agreement and thought that it will cater enough for your situation.
Okay, so essentially it's still valid, but sometimes the details may matter and that might not help you if you just pluck it out of nowhere.
I would think so. It's because I would say that every tenancy is different. For example, this tenancy is about, you know, allowing a person to stay in the room within the condo. So it's not the entire unit, for example. So then how do you deal with things like electricity? How do you deal with things like, is it a furnished unit, not furnished? And did you identify the furnished item within? What about the sharing and usage of the living area or the kitchen and things like that? So whether you need to regulate that properly or not.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll have more of your questions and answers from Chris after these messages. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Property Show in the Morning Run. I'm Sim Wee Boon, and I've got Chris Tan here of Chir Associates with me for the monthly property legal clinic. It takes place every last Friday of the month. Okay, our next question comes from Aro, and this is the situation he's describing. I have a tenant for a house that I own that hasn't been paying his rent. I've reached out multiple times and have not been able to get in touch with him. I'm planning to evict him, but where do I begin? Do I need to contact the police? And are there any special considerations given that it's currently an MCO?
Well, as far as MCO is concerned, there is such thing called the COVID-19 Act, which have been passed, which is applicable to commercial immovable property only, but specifically not relation to residential that I think RO is addressing at the moment, right? So other than that, so we can focus if it's residential means that the impact of COVID-19 Act is not there. On that basis, if the tenant is in default on renter, the landlord may issue a letter to the tenant demanding him to pay for the outstanding renter within certain period, failing which you may proceed to issue a notice for termination or eviction demanding for the delivery of vacant possession, right? Should the tenant actually fail to comply with the said notice, the landlord is entitled to file to the court to apply for a few things. Number one, to file a claim to claim for the outstanding arrears in renter and also to claim for the vacant possession. And upon obtaining the judgment from the court and serve on the tenant, and in the event the tenant still refuses to vacate the premise, then the landlord can file a writ of possession to the court again, whereby the court bailiff will go to the premises to evict by way of forced entry.
And who does the eviction? Is it the police? And does the owner need to be present? I mean, what are these other considerations?
My answer just now is the word called court bailiff. Basically, it's an officer of the court who have this power to do this eviction, and generally not the police. As far as police is concerned, I think the engagement would be, you know, making a good police report before the forced entry would be helpful, just to say that you have a judgment proper, that's why you're doing this and whatever that is. And if there's any incidents during the entry also, maybe there is a subsequent police report to report as to what happened. This is good enough to protect the landlord.
Okay, so say the eviction happens. What happens to the tenants, the evicted tenants' property in the premise, in the couches, the TVs that he's had? Does it now belong to the landlord, or does the landlord have the responsibility to box it up and throw it out? I mean, what happens to those possessions?
Definitely does not belong to the landlord for sure. Those are the possession of the tenant and the belonging of the tenant. Like, for example, you mentioned couches, TV and all these things. There are also issues whether those things are actually the tenant's belonging or not. So if you understand recovery of possession for all intended purposes to get back the place, the premise, of course, unless there is otherwise provided in the court order whereby there is also a writ of seizure of the asset is also granted, whereby you can actually take those assets and actually sell it off on a forced sale situation. But other than that, those things need to return to the tenant proper.
Recently, the federal court has ruled that payment due from housing developers to purchasers for late delivery of houses should be calculated from the date the booking fee is paid and not the date the sale S&P is signed. So I just want to talk a bit about the implications of this case. I mean, what kind of implication will this have, especially given now with COVID-19 in the play? You know, I'm very sure that there might be late delivery of properties. So, I mean, maybe you can give some of your take or some of your insights into this, Chris.
I think first and foremost, this is already a settled law before this case as well, because there's other court case that actually also decided on a similar manner. It's just that this case is now brought up to the apex court of the land, which is the federal court, whereby the federal court is giving the ultimate decision in relation to this, to say that first and foremost, the consideration by the court is to say that, you know, the Housing Development Act 1966 is actually a social legislation. And given that it is a social legislation to protect the homeowner in relation to this, the court have taken the intention of Parliament into the consideration and therefore interpret it in a manner to protect the homeowner in relation to this matter. So the court have decided the date of the payment of the deposit, which is ruled as illegal by the court. But since they have collected it, then therefore the date of payment itself is the date of a committed contract. It is in place. So for all intents and purposes, the moment that you pay the 5,000, the 3,000, or how much that you are paying, although you have not signed a proper agreement, the completion expected to deliver vacant possession start from that day. And if there's a late delivery, it should count it back up to that date. So it's not the date of you actually signing the agreement. So I think to the homeowner, this means better protection. To the developer, they really have to examine the practice of collecting deposit before signing of the agreement seriously. I think it can bite both ways, given that it's social legislation, like I said, although the specific wording of the law did provide for the date of the agreement as where it starts. But I also want to highlight that there could be a situation whereby the purchaser or the homeowner want to terminate the contract and there's an issue of forfeiture. If you want to highlight that, if the termination happened during the deposit paid, whether there's a refund of the deposit or whether we follow the agreement to say that, you know, actually the forfeiture is 10%. Although you pay a 5,000, but you have to pay for the balance of the 10% that's remain an issue that could possibly trigger from this agreement, from this judgment of the court. So that's my observation. And as far as the MCO is concerned, again, it's the COVID-19 Act that I'm talking about, whether there's any exclusion in relation to this, in relation to this delivery. There are some specific exclusion under the law, but we have to look at your unique circumstances to see how applicable and how it applies to you in your unique circumstances.
Okay, I just want to dial back the conversation a bit to this booking fee. I remember that we had a conversation last year about booking fees, and it's somewhat, if I recall correctly, this term booking fees operates in somewhat of a gray area. Does this court decision then kind of like solidify and officiate the process of developers being able to take booking fees?
I think this court have actually ruled that, you know, as far as is there any illegality in relation to collection of booking fees? The answer is yes, they have affirmed it. They have confirmed that it's illegal by the decision of this court.
And that's all the time we have for the Monthly Property Legal Clinic today. Thanks as always, Chris. Join us again on the Monthly Property Legal Clinic next month as we shed light on your legal conundrums and get some answers for them. Send your questions to property@bfm.my or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. I'm Sim Wee Boon, signing up for the morning run. The 10 a.m. news bulletin is coming up next, followed by Enterprise, PFM 89.9.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.